It's Monday with Morley's. We try to bring Morley Robbins in, the magnesium man, which I don't even call you that anymore, Morley. It's because it's moved on from magnesium to the iron man and retinol man and ferrooxidase man, the decathlete of ferrooxidase. Yeah. But anyways, we've got Morley Robbins with us today and his website, rcp123.org. Nifty little jingle to it, but that stands for Root Cause Protocol 123.org. So Morley, welcome. Thanks for joining us again.
Well, thank you, Dr. Ben. We're really happy to be here and look forward to our discussion this morning.
Yes, I do too. I hope the listeners do. I know sometimes it gets a little deep, but we'll try to bring it back into layman's terms. And actually, I mean, from what the articles you've been sending this past month or so, the thing is it keeps actually kind of getting simpler and simpler. It keeps pointing back to these very basic things, and it's easy for patients, educated patients. A number of people that come see us have already done tons of education in the functional integrative medicine realm. And so physicians or practitioners in the integrative realm and even patients that are educated this way, they have a deep understanding of some stuff to a degree. Sometimes that gets us in trouble, though, because it keeps coming back to these basic concepts. I mean, we know inflammation, oxidation, free radicals are kind of the common denominator of everything. But it boils down to these basic systems in the body that are designed to handle these oxidants, handle the free radicals, handle the oxidative stress. The body's got to be equipped to do that, though. And there's a common theme, continuing to come back to this common theme of something that binds up and keeps that system from working right. So a lot of what we'll talk about today probably will sound familiar, but it's just going to reiterate what we've talked about a lot, that it's not that, I think, as you put in your last email, it's really not rocket science. It's science,
right.
But it's not rocket science, and there is a lot of science behind all this, so... Anyways, let's dive in with wherever you want to go. The latest, greatest things you've been learning in the past month or so since we spoke last. Enlighten us.
Yeah, this will be an interesting exchange, because I think you're absolutely right. We're revisiting some old ground, but we're also going to introduce some new concepts. But I think you're absolutely right. It does get simpler and simpler, though. It's like the we're turning a lens, and things are beginning to come more and more into focus about what are the macro events that are causing all of this dysregulation and dysfunction in our body. So I was reading this morning an article by a Dr. Rockman. He was a noted hematologist. Hepatologist, excuse me, you've studied the liver. And this is an article from 1987. And this is the first sentence of the article. I thought it was pretty interesting. The liver is the main storage site of vitamin A and copper. I thought, wow, that's interesting. And wow, I think intuitively that makes sense. We certainly would probably have assumed that. I'd never seen it in writing before. That the liver is the main storage site for vitamin A and copper. And what's the fastest growing liver disease on the planet?
Fatty liver.
Fatty liver. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease.
Yeah, it's almost like the norm now. These mild elevations in your liver enzymes, and oh, you got fatty liver, and that's just the way it is. It's the new norm in America.
It's the new norm, but it should be freaking people out, because non-alcoholic fatty liver disease means that vitamin A is deficient, means that copper is deficient, and it means that iron is in an excess position in the liver. Mm-hmm. So not only is the liver the main storage site for vitamin A and copper, it's also the first place that iron goes when there's excess iron in the system. It's the iron storage depot as well. So then we've, right away, we've got a conflict. We've got, again, we can't live without iron. We know that. But but we can't age without iron either. And this idea that aging just comes from Mars, we got to stop thinking that. Aging is not adding more years to our frame, it's adding more iron to our physiology.
Yeah, because iron is going to rust. I mean, if you think about a vehicle, it seems like a simple analogy, but these vehicles rust out. An old tractor out in the field that's not covered and exposed to all the weather, and it's going to rust out. You're going to rust from the inside. I mean, depending on your belief system, all my patients know, I believe our days are numbered, that day's set, but it's the quality of life, it's the health span we're after, not the lifespan. And so how quickly are you going to wear down, insert rust, how quickly is this oxidative stress and these reactive oxygen species going to rust you from inside out? These little age spots, I think we'll talk about later, on the skin, that seems simple, and all the old people get age spots, these little brown spots, but that's one form of this rusting process. But it can happen in your eyeballs and your heart and your kidney and your brain, all over the place. And iron is a key factor in this, obviously, to rust. You've got to have the iron. But go ahead.
And one of the things, but that's an important thing for the listeners to connect, is that there is a rusting process that's happening not just outside our body. We know that. We can recognize that, like the tractor you're talking about. But that same rusting process is occurring inside our body, but no one's ever been told that. They've never been informed about exactly how that happens. And that, I think, is the basis of a lot of our dialogue, that there is this rusting process. So let's accept that. And then what's, I think, fascinating about the body is that there's a recycling program. It's a very important part of our physiology, is the ability to reuse iron. We don't eat it and then discharge it in our feces. Actually, there's almost no release of iron once it gets past our teeth. It's amazing. I mean, this goes back all the way to the research of a famed team out of London. 1937, they published an article in Lancet magazine. That's the top of the pecking order. Maybe Nature would be above Lancet, but it's a prestigious medical journal. And McCants and Widdowson, McCants was a physician, Widdowson was a PhD chemist, and they made it very clear that there's no iron that leaves the body through the intestine. That's an important thing for people to know. So that once iron gets in our body through our mouth, through whether it's food or supplements or whatever, then we've got to deal with it. And what really is important is something called the daily iron requirement, which is very different than a nutritional RV, you know, required value, or, you know, they've got like 18 different variations of those initials. But every 24 hours, we need to have available 24 milligrams of iron from our recycling system, to which we add 1 milligram of iron from our diet, and that 25 milligrams of iron makes the next day's batch of red blood cells.
Go ahead. I just pulled up the Cheerios nutrition facts. In one serving of Cheerios, which is only one cup, which I don't know anybody who would eat just one cup of Cheerios. I think everybody's bowl probably fills two cups or more.
Yep.
8 milligrams of iron in one serving, one cup of Cheerios. So you're getting 16 milligrams if you do two cups, and that's just your Cheerios. That's not your iron-fortified whole wheat bread that you eat with the Cheerios, or the milk or the OJ that's iron-fortified, and that doesn't even count your snack, your lunch, your dinner, and everything else. So just with one cup, you're getting 8 milligrams of iron. You just said we need 1 milligram a day from the diet.
1 milligram a day from the diet, and then there's three different forms of iron that come through food. We have heme iron, so when we eat a hamburger or a steak, it's red, right? And that red is from heme. It's a protein that's very instrumental for carrying oxygen. And what makes the heme red is iron plus oxygen. That iron oxide is, it's red. There's your rust right there, folks. But in that setting, it's not going to cause a problem. But that's heme iron. Then we have what's called non-heme iron. That's an organic form of iron that vegetables and grains provide. And it's a useful form of iron that the body knows what to do with. And then we have inorganic iron, which is what's in supplementation programs, enrichment programs. So when we're talking about iron fortified Cheerios, bread, rice, whatever the food is, they're using inorganic iron.
Mm-hmm.
So we absorb about maybe 20% of inorganic iron, 40% of heme iron, and 60% of inorganic iron. So the iron-fortified foods that we don't even think about are providing the biggest dose of iron is inorganic. That's a polite way of saying iron filings, which then immediately creates the rusting process that you and I started the conversation with. So under normal physiology, which is, I think, hard to find now on the planet, but under normal physiology, this recycling program is capturing and recycling 24 milligrams. Anything that involves recycling in the human body does so at the direction of bioavailable copper. Whether we're talking about recycling cholesterol in our brain, or whether we're talking about recycling iron in our body, especially in our liver and bone marrow. So right away, we are dependent on copper to make this iron thingy work. And so then we've got 95% of the iron for this daily iron requirement is coming from a recycling program. 5% is coming from our mouth. Now, what adds to the excitement is that 95% of the research is on the absorption of iron, not the recycling of iron. So the scientific journals are looking at the least important aspect of iron.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first step. Then what we have is that recycling program depends on a waste management process in the stomach of our cells, especially in the stomach of they're called iron recycling macrophages. Macrophage is a Pac-Man, gobbles up red blood cells, and basically needs to break down the red blood cell into its component parts and capture that heat, that iron, and make sure that it's going to be available for use in the daily process of making new blood cells.
Yeah, so basically 80% of the iron in the body is in these red blood cells. The red blood cells are constantly dying, so the macrophage or Pac-Man gobbles up the dying ones and takes that iron, recycles it, and pushes it back to the bone marrow so the bone marrow can make a new red blood cell. And it's just this beautiful recycling system, but this gobbling up, the trash man basically taking that iron and recycling it, is the macrophage, key component of the management and recycling system.
And the recycling system in the macrophage takes place in something called the lysosome, L-Y-S-O-O-M-E, lysosome, and that's the waste management system of the cell. And here's the catch. That system needs to let the iron out. Iron's got to get out of that stomach so that it can be used elsewhere in the body. Well, the doorway to let that iron out is called ferroportin. And if ferroportin's not working, then the iron doesn't get out. It starts to build up in that cell and in that stomach. And that's where a major breakdown is in the system. And again, that doorway, they have bioavailable copper to work right. So we've got this tremendous need for recycling, and then we find out that, boy, whatever iron comes in our mouth stays in our body because it's not going to be excreted. The only recognized way to regulate the loss of iron is through blood loss. And that's why women have a biological advantage over men. That's why they don't have the age-related diseases at the same rate as their peers at the same age, because they've had less exposure to iron over the course of their lifetime.
Yeah. So once that iron's into you, the body does not have a good way to release that iron. You're not going to poop it out. You're not going to excrete it through your digestive. Your normal processes in the body is to grab toxic stuff, put it to the urine through your kidney, or put it to your bowel through your gallbladder, basically your liver gallbladder, squirt it into your intestine. Your intestine sends it to the toilet. But the body doesn't do that with iron. That's the study you quoted a while ago. Iron does not get excreted through the digestive tract. So once it's in you, it's in you, and you recycle a lot of it. If you lose blood, you'll lose a little bit, but otherwise it's in you.
Right. So then we have, there's three ways of measuring iron status, or iron homeostasis is a better word. Iron homeostasis is measured with hemoglobin. Again, back to the bulk of iron in the body is in hemoglobin, which is inside red blood cells. That's about 80% of the iron. It's an enormous percentage, obviously. Well, you can't make hemoglobin, and you can't turn over hemoglobin unless you have bioavailable copper. Then we find out another way to measure iron status is serum iron. And that marker is telling us how well this recycling program is working. So if there's supposed to be 100 units of serum iron in a woman's body and 120 units of serum iron in a man's body, again, men can handle more iron because of the testosterone in our system. I'd love to know why we're able to do that. Maybe you know, but there is a differential in terms of how much iron we can handle as men versus women. And when that number is close to 100 or 120, it's like miles per gallon. It's humming at its optimal level. And when that number is below 100 or below 120, you know that the efficiency of that recycling program is faltering because of a lack of bioavailable copper, because the iron can't get out of the stomach of the macrophage. So there's a breakdown there. And that's a very important breakdown area, but that's a second way to measure how well is the iron doing. And then we come to the third way, which is called serum ferritin. And that is, we've been taught to believe, is a definitive marker for how iron is being stored in the body.
Morley, before you go on to the ferritin, what if the serum iron is high? What does that tell you about the recycling system, if anything?
I think what it's telling us is the system is running hot. And when there's more iron than you would expect to see, it just means that the body is overloaded with iron. And I don't have a specific metabolic pathway to prove that. It's just intuitively, we know that it's going too fast. It's generating too much iron in the serum. And so maybe it's a function of the turnover rate of the red blood cells. They may be running too fast, and that might be adding to the iron. I've never been able to find a definitive scientific explanation for why that number would rise.
Okay.
And it's a very small, it's probably less than 1% of the clients I've worked with have too much serum iron above that threshold. It's about, I would say 90% of my clients have serum iron that's below 100 or below 120 if they're a man.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting point. If people kind of start to learn this iron thing's bad and they check their serum iron and it flags it as low, and they're going to think, I guess I need more iron. But what you just explained was it's a marker for decreased efficiency of the recycling system. So the iron's actually stuck inside the macrophage, the Pac-Man that's chewing all the red blood cells up. It takes that iron in. It can't release it properly back to the bone to make more red blood cells. The iron gets stuck inside the Pac-Man, and so your blood test will say you're low on your serum iron. And then the third marker, you were saying ferritin before I interrupted. Let's go into that. What is ferritin?
Yeah. So we have this serum ferritin, and before we take that dive, I want to make sure people understand that from 1860 to 1972, so for over a century, scientists and clinicians knew that the most definitive marker for iron status was hemoglobin, because that's where the biggest bulk of iron is. It's 80% of the iron. It's called, the formal term is called the erythron. It's more than just the red blood cells. It's all the tissue that's involved in manufacturing the precursors. And, you know, we don't need to go into that technicality. But that 80% of iron is all surrounding this issue of red blood cells. Less than 10% is found in ferritin. So that's an important thing to know, is that in 1972, of a group of hematologists in London, headed up by Dr. Alan Jacobs, in 1972, they published an article in the British Medical Journal, and it moved the spotlight away from hemoglobin to ferritin. Said, this is a better way to measure it. And then in 1975, he said, oh, this is absolutely the bee's knees for measuring iron status is ferritin. And that started to shape the thinking of clinicians around the world. When did you go to medical school, Dr. Ben?
98 to 2002.
So by then, it had been a well-established fact that ferritin was the definitive marker for measuring iron status. And it's ferritin is a storage protein for iron. And here's where it gets really exciting. The ferritin molecule has three different forms. We think that, oh, it's ferritin, it's, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's inside the cell or outside the cell, it's all the same thing. No, it actually matters a whole lot. So that ferritin protein only exists in a body that has too much iron. That's an important thing to understand. And then secondly, according to Jerry Sullivan, who was a pathologist over in Florida, he got his medical degree about 20 years before you did, but his focus was on the iron-heart relationship, that all heart disease was caused by too much iron. And he, in one of his more celebrated articles, he said, there is no known physiological function for ferritin in human physiology. It's just a storage depot, period. And so then what we've got to understand is that this ferritin molecule or this ferritin protein can have a letter H in front of it or a letter L in front of it. H, typically they'll refer to it as what's found in the heart or what's found, it's called blanking what the other term for H is, but what it really stands for is high catalytic activity. What that means is that H form of ferritin has ferrooxidase enzyme function. And the L form stands for heavy, and the L stands for light, which is found in the liver. It's more dominant in the liver, but it also stands for low or no catalytic activity. So it turns out that ferritin inside the cell, it's a mixture, it's a blend of this H and L, and it's essential to have that ferrooxidase enzyme function, because you can't load iron into ferritin unless that enzyme is present. Again, you can't move iron unless copper is nearby. Very important thing to understand. So then what we've been trained to believe, and I'm sure in your training, there was tremendous emphasis placed on serum ferritin as a surrogate for ferritin inside the cell.
Yes.
And that's
a marker for iron status in general.
Exactly. It's a known fact that serum ferritin is the accepted marker for how's the iron status in this person. Mm-hmm. Ignoring the fact that it's less than 10% of the iron, ignoring the fact that it was always hemoglobin that was always the marker. Now we're supposed to believe that the serum ferritin. Well, it turns out that in 1977, Dr. Jacobs and one of his colleagues, Dr. Worward, W-O-R-W-O-O-D, they published an article that said, wow, what a surprise. There's no iron in this serum ferritin. And then a year later, a Dr. Arosio from Italy said, yeah, you guys were right. There's no iron in this thing. And then we fast forward to 2014, and Douglas Kell and Etheresia Pretorius from South Africa. Kell's from University of Manchester. Pretorius is from South Africa. They wrote a very important article about ferritin is just a marker for inflammation. But here's the kicker. Serum ferritin, and I know you love analogies because you've got this great analogy now for ferrooxidase. It's the Swiss Army knife inside the body. I love that analogy because it just captures the essential functionality of that protein and all the enzymes. Well, here's a good, I hope this is what people will regard as a good analogy for serum ferritin is, these are empty shotgun shells inside your blood.
Mm, yeah.
And they've already expended the iron in the stomach of the macrophage. The iron has already been, has spilled its guts, literally, into the stomach of the cell. Now here's where it gets fascinating. Because what I've always wanted to understand is, why does ferritin go high in some people, and why does it go low in some people? And I'm sure you've seen the same thing.
Yep.
You got your seatbelt on?
Fascinating, you know. I'm on the edge of my seat.
Okay. I don't want you to fall off.
I hope the listeners are too.
Yeah, I hope so too. No, because I think it's very important. People know that when ferritin gets too high, when it gets above 150 for a woman or above 300 for a guy, a well-trained physician knows that's too much serum ferritin, and it's a marker for inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
And you can connect high ferritin to just about every inflammatory disorder known to man.
Yeah.
Or woman.
Well known.
Well
recognized. Well known. Even conventional docs.
So it turns out that the serum ferritin gets secreted out of the lysosome, out of the cell, and goes into the blood under one specific condition. When insulin gets made in our body, there's also another hormone that gets made. It's called C-peptide hormone. C-peptide hormone has very important roles to play in the body, but if it gets attached to unbound copper, leaves the cell and causes ferritin to be secreted out of the cell. Now, the listeners might be thinking, well, what's causing that to happen? The process of inflammation causes the ceruloplasm to lose its enzyme function. Coppers start leaking out, and they start grabbing onto the C-peptide hormone. And then suddenly this process of recycling in the lysosome starts to get funky. Iron starts to be dumped, and these empty shotgun shells get secreted out of the tissue into the blood.
Okay.
So that's high ferritin.
Wait, let's pause.
Yeah, right, okay.
Let's digest that a little bit because we got deep. So inflammation causes ceruloplasm to lose its copper.
Right.
Basically. So I want to remind everybody, ceruloplasm is that's the doorman. That's a protein that works, acts as an enzyme, and it opens that door for copper to move around, basically. Or, excuse me, iron to move around. But copper runs ceruloplasm. You got to have copper in the ceruloplasm to be able to move this iron around. So if you lose the copper out of ceruloplasm, then this process gets slowed down or stopped. So what you're saying is C-peptide, which is secreted by the body when you eat carbs, especially processed carbs and sugars. When you,
you spike insulin,
you spike C-peptide. C-peptide's going to bind up with this copper that's floating around unattended that got dumped out of the ceruloplasm because of inflammation. And that's the main trigger for ferritin to be dumped out of the cell.
Exactly. And so C-peptide is supposed to stay inside the cell. Unless the copper is unbound, there's rising unbound copper in the cell, and suddenly its whole function changes, and then it triggers this mechanism to expend the empty shotgun shells.
Okay. We're going to have to take a break because we're about at that time, but I want to, I mean, I'm sure you have a, you're going somewhere more with this, but one question I want to throw out to you that we'll answer later. We, the listeners really need to know all the things that will cause copper to not be available, not bioavailable, not workable, not being used in that ceruloplasm, all the things that will kick it out or make it not useful to work. So we'll, we want to touch on all those when we get back.
How much time do we have?
Maybe July and August. We'll
that's a very important question. We'll get that in today.
Okay.
That's important. Yeah.
But we'll finish. You were going somewhere with ferritin, too, before I started reinforce this ceruloplasm copper issue and the C-peptide. So when we get back from the break, we'll keep going with the ferritin and see where else this rabbit hole leads. So stick with us. You're listening to Morley Robbins. RCP123.org is his website. And this is Dr. Ben Edwards with Veritas Medical, and you're the cure. We will be right back. Everyone's kind of sticking with us, and let me bring you back and kind of summarize the first half hour, which is basically the body needs iron, obviously, to function. Iron carries oxygen around to the body. The way it does that is through the red blood cell. So iron is mostly in our red blood cell. 80% of the iron in the body is in the red blood cell to carry the oxygen around the body, to deliver it to every cell of the body. We need that oxygen to make energy. So iron's important. It's in the red blood cells. The red blood cells live anywhere from a couple months, maybe 3 or 4 months, but then they die. And so the pack men of the body, the macrophage, gobbles up these dying red blood cells. And the pack men will get that iron and recycle it, send it back to the bone marrow to make new red blood cells. So that's just the recycling system we've been talking about. So you need very little dietary iron, 1 milligram in your diet, which I mentioned earlier, 1 cup of Cheerios has 8 milligrams because of iron fortification of mostly the grains. But the American diet has been iron fortified, so we're getting easily 15, 20, 30 milligrams of iron dietarily if you're a standard American and you need 1 milligram. So this recycling system can start to malfunction. And if it does malfunction, you've got this extra iron, excess iron inside your cell, inside the Pac-Man, leaking out of the cell. I mean, just extra iron in the body will mix with this oxygen that every cell of the body needs to make energy. Oxygen plus extra unbound excess iron in your system will cause rust. Oxidation is the scientific name for that. And this oxidative process is a common theme throughout all degenerative disease, whether you're talking arthritis, Alzheimer's, aging spots, skin issues, wrinkling of your skin, whatever, and just aging processes in general, there's this oxidative component to it. So you've got to have antioxidant capacity to be able to handle these oxidants. But it'd also be nice not to have so many oxidants. And iron is what's creating a lot of these oxidants. Not every single oxidant in the body is because of iron, but it's a big component, especially when you're feeding yourself all this extra iron. So it's a big part of fixing yourself and a big part of the dietary interventions that I recommend and Morley recommends is stop eating this extra iron, number one. Stop being a standard American dieter. And that's a big, you'll go a long ways. But then second to that is you got to fix your recycling system. Part of it will fix just because you have less iron coming in for the body to have to try to handle. But the other part is you need this bioavailable copper. And we'll talk more about that. But where we were going next was this ferritin marker, which most doctors understand when it's high, it means inflammation, but most doctors think when it's too low, it means you need more iron. And that's where the real question lies, and what we're trying to get to today is, wait a minute, there's more to this ferritin thing. And even I in the past was wrong saying, oh, ferritin's basically iron. So if your ferritin's low, your iron's low. Take some iron supplements. Well, what we just learned in the first half is ferritin's not iron at all. It's just a storage vault. It's a protein that holds iron. Your body will put iron into ferritin to store it. But the research has come out that Morley's talked about earlier is once the ferritin dumps, gets excreted out of your cell into your blood, where we can actually measure it now as a doctor, that ferritin doesn't even have iron in it. Something happened where it released all its iron inside the cell and then got excreted outside the cell, almost as like this red flag of, hey, guys, look, we've got a major problem here. We've got a bunch of ferritin in the blood. It's not actually iron in it, but it's a marker of inflammation. So all this extra iron is inside the cell wreaking havoc, mixing with oxygen species, reactive oxygen species, and just causing atom bombs to go off inside the cell. So there's the summary, Morley.
Great summary.
Where was your next step with the ferritin?
Yes, we just talked about the high ferritin. So what the listeners need to understand is there's two poles of thought. The simple lie and the complex truth. And what we're engaged in here, what I really appreciate about Dr. Ben is his willingness to explore the complex truth. Because the simple lie is, oh, your iron is low. You just take more. And what you just shared with the listeners is you did that at one point in your career, which is what 99.999% of doctors do. Oh, your iron's low, referring to ferritin, not knowing what it is. And the complex truth is a little bit more involved as we're learning. So that's the important backdrop to this discussion, is we're really trying to pull the curtain back on what's really taking place. Well, then we have the low ferritin angle. And I know I'm sure this conversation with the listeners before, but just to amplify it, I had the good fortune of actually talking with Dr. Douglas Kell a couple of years ago. It was just about 2 years ago now. And I asked him point blank. I said, Dr. Kell, what is the ideal ferritin in a human body? And he looked at me. He's my age. Got this wall of books behind him. It's a very distinguished iron biologist. And he said, zero. And I looked at him in disbelief. I said, excuse me? And then he said the following. He said, Morley, I want to make sure you understand this. Ferritin is not synthesized in the blood. It is secreted into the blood. High ferritin is not a sign of iron vitality. It is a sign of organ pathophysiology. Do you understand what I'm saying? And I looked him in the eye and said, perfectly. And it was a light bulb moment. Obviously, I memorized that passage because it was so profound. But what's happening on this planet, I would venture to say hundreds of thousands of times a day, is doctors are doing blood tests. Doesn't matter what degree they have after their name. We're not singling out any one faith over another. But all doctors have been trained to think that ferritin equals iron. And if ferritin is low, you need more iron. No. 1,000 times no. So what is low ferritin? Well, low ferritin, here's a very important figure in this is a hematologist from Japan. His name is Hiroshi Saito, S-A-I-T-O. His first notable publication was in 1958. And he just published an important article earlier this year. So for 60 years, he's been studying iron. How does iron get stored in the body? Nobody knows this better than Dr. Saito. And what he tells us in a particularly important article that he wrote in 2014 is that ferritin and hemosiderin. The listeners are going, hemo what? But ferritin and hemosiderin are of equal importance in storing iron. And in fact, they share 9 metabolic pathways where they're talking to each other and exchanging iron between each other. Wow. Didn't know all that. And then what we find out is that there's this compound that begins to build inside the stomach of these macrophages. It's called lipofuscin. L-I-P-O-F-U-S-C-I-N. And for any of the listeners who have any kind of eye disease, I'm sure your ophthalmologist or your optometrist has told you about the lipofuscin in your retina, and it's connected to just about every eye disorder known to man or woman. Age-related macular degeneration is probably the most notable. Well, guess what? The eye is a reflection of the liver. So if there's lipofuscin in the eye, I can assure you there's lipofuscin in the in the liver, and that's really what non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is. It's a buildup of lipofuscin in that organ, and it's very destructive when it happens. Why? Because iron builds in lipofuscin the same way it builds in hemosiderin, and there seems to be this thin veil between. What's the difference between hemosiderin and lipofuscin? I can't tell. So what we're finding is that when ferritin gets low, clearly we don't have this insulinish dynamic taking place, but what's important for the listeners to understand is that when ferritin is low, it means that there's low bioavailable copper, and you need bioavailable copper acting as the ferrooxidase enzyme to load iron into ferritin. And when it cannot do that, it loads it into hemosiderin. And so doctors do not measure hemosiderin, nor do they measure lipofuscin. Not because they aren't available, they just have not been trained to do that. They've been trained. Doctors are very good at following rules. They do what they've been trained to do. And so they've been trained to measure serum ferritin as a marker for iron, when in fact it is the most irrelevant marker. It is a false flag. And what the listeners may have heard me say before is I now refer to ferritin as erritin, E-R-R-O-R-I-T-I-N. And the thing is, we've got to stop using ferritin as a marker. We need to understand the whole 360 view of what's going on with iron. And we both low ferritin and high ferritin are markers for low bioavailable copper. Okay. The low ferritin is the iron can't get loaded into the protein, and the high ferritin is the copper is leaking out because of an inflammatory process that affects our blood sugar regulation. There you go.
Okay, that's a lot to wrap your mind around. Low bioavailable copper really is at the root of both high and low ferritin.
Exactly.
Other mechanisms obviously involved that help determine which way it's going to go, high or low. I think we lost people on the hemosiderin thing. Hemosiderin's another storage vault for iron. Ferritin's a storage vault for iron. Would I be wrong in assuming or saying that if your ferritin's really low, that hemosiderin would be inversely proportionally high?
If you follow the work of Dr. Sato, yes.
Okay. So to really get a complete look at this, we should be measuring both. If ferritin's low, I would assume from a physician standpoint, if someone's symptom-free, they look healthy, otherwise symptom-free, all their blood work looks super great, they have zero complaints, and their ferritin's really, really low, like a 5, I would say, okay, maybe that's just normal. But if someone has an autoimmune disease, they're inflamed, they have lots of symptoms, and their ferritin's 5, then I might think, it's probably just all over in the hemosiderin molecule. So let's measure hemosiderin if that's even possible in a clinical lab.
It is. You can measure it in the urine and in the blood. It's just not routine. That's all. And so what happens with iron is it's hide and seek. So think of, again, hide and seek. Hide begins with H. Well, that's hemosiderin. And the seek is like the serum ferritin. It's like it shows up in the blood, but it's not telling us what the iron status is. Mm-hmm. So, and the here's the last point I want to make, and then we'll get to how do we stop copper from leaking out of ceruloplasm, because that's very important. What I want the listeners to understand is that back to this dietary iron, back to these Cheerios, there are actually cereals, Dr. Ben, where the half cup of cereal can have as much as 18 milligrams of iron. Mm. I've seen that in supermarkets. So these numbers can get much, much higher than just the Cheerios. And so, and again, that's a half a cup. And again, just like you said, who in their right mind has a half a cup of cereal? They have two cups. So now we're at 72 milligrams of iron, and we haven't even gotten past the cereal.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the take-home message today. Quit eating extra iron. You only need a milligram. The body's going to recycle 24 of the 25 milligrams you need in a day. Most of the iron's in the red blood cell. Red blood cells get recycled. I mean, that's the take-home message here is we have an amazing recycling system. Quit feeding all this excess iron. If your blood test says you're low or high, just understand there's way more to it. It's way more complicated than simple numbers on the blood test. Those are clues, but you've got to have a deeper understanding of all these pathways to make an accurate interpretation of that blood work.
So then let's bring it home. This is very important research, again, from Dr. Sato. Dietary iron becomes what's called cellular labile iron. And what that's code for is labile doesn't mean free. It means reactive. It means toxic. So when we eat iron in our diet, especially the fortified iron, it's found in cereals and breads and grains, what have you. When we eat that dietary iron, that inorganic iron, it's going immediately into the cell as reactive iron. And then Dr. Sato goes one step farther and refers in footnote number 61 to some work of Dr. Brewer, B-R-E-U-R. And we find out that that cellular labile iron actually goes straight into the mitochondria. So that bowl of Cheerios is drowning your mitochondria with iron, overloading the mitochondria with iron, and they get rusty, and then they can't work right. And when the mitochondria don't work right, they need to go through that waste management system. Same process. And guess what happens? The iron starts spilling out of the mitochondria into the stomachs. And so we have two sources of iron overload in the stomachs of our cells. And so that's where there's a grave crisis, is thinking that we're anemic, taking more iron in our food than we need, especially in our supplements. And that additional form of iron is going straight into the mitochondria and snuffing out the ability to make energy. And when the energy drops in the cell, this is the work of Jerry Tennant over in Dallas, when the energy level drops in the cell, that's when the pathogens wake up.
The Epstein-Barr, the Lyme, the Candida, these chronic infections that reemerge, and people chase these bugs all day long. And if you can get a big enough hammer and kill enough of those bugs, you'll feel better for a little bit, or maybe for a long time, but eventually they'll reemerge if you don't get deeper into the terrain. The terrain meaning all these workings of the cell that we're talking about, that these different pathways of the cell have to work right. You have to make energy the right way. You have to clear exhaust the right way. You have to deal with iron the right way. You have to deal with oxygen the right way. That's all the terrain we're talking about. So the bugs. Yeah.
So then let's close the wagons on, so how do we stop this process of letting copper to get out of the ceruloplasm? Well, first and foremost, we stop taking ascorbic acid. We have to be very careful. It's called ascorbic acid. It's called ascorbate. It's called sodium ascorbate. It's called calcium ascorbate. There are a lot of different terms for it, but it's chemically doing the exact same thing. It is breaching the ceruloplasmin protein, and it causes copper to leak out, and it causes iron to be stored even deeper in the tissue.
So that's one thing. Ascorbic acid is synthetic vitamin C. It's in 99% of the vitamin C's on the market.
Right. And again, it's fortified in most foods.
Yeah.
So we're drinking orange juice that's got ascorbic acid added to it.
Yeah.
So it's everywhere. Then we've got the issue with vitamin D. What's vitamin D doing? Well, it's blocking the absorption of retinol, vitamin A. Well, we need that retinol in order to make sure that the copper is getting inside that protein. So avoiding synthetic soy-based vitamin D supplements is an imperative to prevent retinol from disappearing from our body. So going out in the sun, I know there's a lot of sunshine in Lubbock, go out in the sunshine, and you know, it doesn't take more than 10 minutes to make enough vitamin D for your body. And so that's another important thing. Antibiotics. Unfortunately, the modern antibiotics today are going to breach the copper enzymes, especially ceruloplasmin is going to be affected. Probably the most notable is Cipro. That's kind of the go-to antibiotic now. Well, Cipro is a fluoroquinolone. If it has the letter F in it, it means it's activated with fluoride, and fluoride and these enzymes don't work right. And so suddenly the copper starts to leak out. Then we find out that birth control pills and hormone replacement therapy, which are based on estrogen is very hard on the ceruloplasmin protein. And it starts to, the inflammatory process rises, and then the copper starts to leak out of that ceruloplasmin protein. So those are a handful of notable ways. And then I think just avoiding high estrogenic foods. Again, we have to avoid commercial foods wherever we can. Yeah. You know, again, we're not asking people to go 100% organic. That's impossible. But if you have a choice, get organic food, not especially organic meats, not meats that have been supplemented with grains that have a high estrogenic basis because of the grains they're eating.
So mostly to keep this copper working in the body, which obviously copper is needed for this whole recycling system to work the right way, you mostly need to avoid synthetic stuff, synthetic vitamin C, synthetic D, the antibiotics,
yep.
The estrogen, which is birth control pills, and estrogenic foods, fluoride. You want to avoid that. And then...
And avoid iron fortified foods.
Yeah.
Too much iron will affect that mechanism as well.
Yep. And then if you want to eat some copper, that's great. Our ancestors got plenty of it in their vegetables because the ground had it, and there were good bugs in the ground, good bacteria and fungi in the ground that unleashed the copper from the soil into the plant. We eat the plant, we get the copper. But 80% of that now, according to Dr. Davis at UT Austin, is not in the vegetables anymore because of our farming techniques. And then dietarily and ancestrally, copper was in the organ meats. People think of iron in the liver, but there's twice as much copper. So if you ate beef liver or other organ meats, you'd get some of this copper. So that's the way to get it in the diet, organ meats and the vegetables. It's if you had vegetables growing in really good soil, but whole food vitamin C, not ascorbic acid, but whole food C will have some copper in it. But mostly, I mean, a lot of this is just stop doing stuff, avoid some stuff. And really, that's the whole root cause protocol. I mean, you didn't list the whole protocol, but everything you listed pretty much is on that root cause protocol that you've come up with. And that's the whole point of the protocol, is how do we get this ceruloplasmin, which needs copper, how do we get copper back into ceruloplasmin that is needed to make this whole recycling process work better? So besides the obvious of quit eating iron, next step is let's get our copper function back, and root cause protocols, how you do it. And we just listed off.
And what's important for folks to really appreciate and come to accept is the body does have an on-off switch. I'm convinced of it. The on switch is bioavailable copper, and the off switch is excess unbound iron hiding in the stomachs of these macrophages. Yeah. And the buildup of iron in that tissue is far more significant than people realize. We've never been taught this, and it really sets into play a very chaotic energy field that's very disruptive to our physiology.
Yeah. Well, that's a great summary, and we're about out of time.
Okay.
And I don't want to launch you into a new thing, but I'm just thinking
out
loud here. One more thought.
Yeah.
If a body had plenty of bioavailable copper, someone's been eating lots of organ meats, whole food vitamin C, not doing a lot of the synthetic stuff we just listed, but you happen to have a lot of iron in you because you were standard American for a number of years. Obviously, donating blood will help get rid of some of that iron, but I'm assuming that with enough bioavailable copper, your body can have enough intracellular storage mechanisms like ferritin and hemosiderin. If you had enough copper, you could handle some of this extra iron. I'm not saying still continue to eat it, but I'm just saying we're overloaded with it. If we just get enough copper in us, I mean, we can calm this whole thing down, and probably our body can just hold on to the extra iron in a safe manner where we can not be burdened and diseased with it. Is that
I think that's a reasonable conclusion, and it builds on what you were sharing at the very beginning of our conversation before we went on air. A new patient that just found that she felt better when she was doing blood work, just taking the blood out for the blood testing, lowered her iron status, and she actually felt better.
Yeah, that's amazing. Okay, so people need to donate some blood. They need to quit eating synthetic stuff and eat some organ meats, whole food vitamin C, and that's a big step in the right direction.
Yeah, and this is this mismatch between bioavailable copper and unbound iron. That's the relay switching station that's connected to every condition, disorder, dysfunction, label that people have. 100% of the time. It isn't 70% of the time. It isn't 42% of the time. It's 100% of the time.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, great. Morley, thank you. It was a deep dive. Listeners, thanks for sticking with us. You're getting highly educated here on You're the Cure. And for you to be the cure, you've got to be highly educated. Then you got to go act on it. So go do that. If this was your first show to ever listen to, go back and listen to all the other Morley shows, and it'll all start to make more sense. RCP123.org is Morley's website. VeritasMedical.com is our website. We'll be back next week with more information for you on how to be the cure for your own self. Morley, thank you again. We really appreciate your time today.
You bet. Thanks so much for the opportunity.